Greetings and turnitalic bibulations, my endophatically quaretic listeners, and welcome to this November 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this confusingly abstemious science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. So, I have it easy this month for Idiot Scientist of the Month. Every year at this time, the Ig Nobel Awards are given out at about the same time as the Nobel Prizes. As usual, these awards, though they may seem utterly idiotic at first, often make you think just a little bit that they are not quite the utter madness that they appear to be. And please note, just like the Nobel Prizes, the Ig Nobel Awards cover decades of research time in terms of where the winners are chosen from. First up, the prize in medicine. Doctors Mark Mitchell and David Weingartner got the award for using roller coaster rides to try to hasten the passage of kidney stones. The title of their work is Validation of a Functional Pyelocaliocele Renal Model for the Evaluation of Renal Calculi Passage While Riding a Roller Coaster. That's from October 2016. Next up, anthropology. Dr. Thomas Person and his group got the award for collecting evidence in a zoo that chimpanzees imitate humans about as often and about as well as humans imitate chimpanzees. Title, Spontaneous Cross-Species Imitation in Interaction Between Chimpanzees and Zoo Visitors. And that's from 2018. Number three, the biology prize goes to Dr. Paul Beecher and his group for demonstrating that wine experts can reliably identify by smell the presence of a single fly in a glass of wine. I'm not entirely sure what the point of that is. I guess it just shows that wine experts have really, really good noses. And the title of this was The Scent of a Fly. And that's from 2017. Number four, the chemistry prize, goes to Dr. Paula Romeo and her group for measuring the degree to which human saliva is a good cleaning agent on dirty surfaces. Again, ew. And the title of this, oddly enough, is Human Saliva as a Cleaning Agent for Dirty Surfaces. And that was published in 1990. Wow. In the journal Studies in Conservation. I looked at the abstract for this, and the idea was that people for centuries have been cleaning things with saliva, so why not actually test just how well saliva works? Number five, the Medical Education Prize goes to Dr. Akira Horiuchi for the medical report, Colonoscopy in the Sitting Position. Lessons learned from self-colonoscopy. And once again, this is really... For those of you who have had colonoscopies, imagine doing it to yourself. I can't even imagine being awake for a colonoscopy, mind you. Anyway, colonoscopy, the title is Colonoscopy in the Sitting Position. Lessons learned from self-colonoscopy by using a small-caliber variable stiffness colonoscope. That's from 2006. Number five, the Literature Prize, goes to Dr. Thea Blackler and her group for documenting that most people who use complicated products do not read the instruction manual. This is actually pretty good because I probably don't do that myself. The title of this was Life is Too Short to Read the Instruction Manual, How Users Relate to Documentation and Excess Features in Consumer Products. That came out of the journal Interacting with Computers in 2014. Number seven, the Nutrition Prize goes to James Cole for calculating the caloric intake from a human cannibalism diet, and that it's significantly lower than the caloric intake from most other traditional meat diets. Okay, I guess the idea was to show that eating humans is really healthy? I don't understand that. Okay, The title of this was Assessing the Caloric Significance of Episodes of Human Cannibalism in the Paleolithic Period.
Sure.
That came out in Scientific Reports in 2017. Number 8, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize goes to Dr. Francesco Alonso and his group for measuring the frequency, motivation, and effects of shouting and cursing while driving an automobile. Yeah, he has to come to Jersey sometime. Okay, and the reference for this was shouting and cursing while driving. Frequency, reasons, perceived risks, and punishments. And that came out in 2017 in the Journal of Sociology and Anthropology. Number 9, Reproductive Medicine Prize goes to Dr. John Barry and his group for using postage stamps to test whether the male sexual organ is functioning properly. I'm not even sure I want to know the details of that. Title of this was Nocturnal Penile Tumescence Monitoring with Stamps. And that came out in 1980 in Neurology. And finally, the Economics Prize goes to Dr. Lindy Hanyu Liang and her group for investigating whether it is effective for employees to use voodoo dolls to retaliate against their abusive bosses. And the title of this was Righting a Wrong, Retaliation on a Voodoo Doll Symbolizing an Abusive Supervisor Restores Justice. That's relatively recent, too. It came out in Leadership Quarterly in February 2018. Wow. Okay. The first actual story of the night. Coffee has now been shown to be good for you, but is hot brewed coffee better for you than cold brewed? And the answer appears to be yes. Doctors Nina Rao and Megan Fuller of Thomas Jefferson University found that your cold brew coffee is not as healthy as hot coffee. That does not mean that cold coffee is unhealthy, just less healthy. Hot brewed coffee has higher levels of antioxidants, which are believed to be responsible for some of the health benefits of coffee. Now, the two researchers found that the pH levels of both hot and cold coffee were similar, ranging from about 4.85 to about 5.13 for all the coffee samples tested. Coffee companies and lifestyle blogs have tended to tout cold brew coffee as being less acidic than hot coffee. I've read those myself, and I thought that was the truth, but it seems that it's not, and they basically said that it was less likely to cause heartburn or gastrointestinal problems because it was less acidic. And again, I believe this myself for the last couple of years, but apparently, it's not true. Fuller and Rao found that the hot brewed coffee method had more total titratable acids, which may be responsible for the hot cup's higher antioxidant levels. Fuller said, quote, coffee has a lot of antioxidants. If you drink it in moderation, our research shows it can be pretty good for you. We found the hot brew has more antioxidant capacity, unquote. Next story. Now, it's always been my belief, whether I'm watching a real horse, or cartoon horse, actually, for that matter, maybe that's where I learned it, the cartoons, that a horse's tail is swishing in order to knock flies out of the air. It turns out that since a horse can't really aim its tail, it can't really hit flies out of the air. It also turns out that tail swishing in mammals is both more complex and, well, sort of more simple in terms of animal-fly interactions than we ever thought. Dr. Marguerite Mathern from Georgia Tech University published a paper last month in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Mathern states, as the purpose of her work, that, like me, quote, most people assume that horses and other mammals swing their tails as some kind of a deterrent for bugs, and we wanted to provide scientific evidence for this claim, unquote. So she traveled to the stables where she had ridden regularly as an undergraduate, and she filmed horses there swishing their tails while under fly attack. For comparison, she also visited the Atlanta Zoo to film the rear ends of animals ranging from giraffes and zebras to elephants. Then she digitized the movements of each animal's tail and then calculated the natural frequencies at which the tail should swing. And she was surprised. The animals were swinging their tails 3 times faster than she had expected and using almost 30 times more energy. She wondered, however, whether they were swinging their tails to intercept more insects. But the problem was, even that at top speed, which is about 0.35 meters per second for the tip of a horse's tail, they could only intercept about one insect every 90 seconds or so. However, she went out and purchased a horsehair whip, and she was surprised to see that mosquitoes take flight even when the whip just merely whistled past. So were the tails generating a breeze that were sufficient to repel potential bloodsuckers? Yeah, the answer was yes. She constructed a robot tail built from a strip of black plastic attached to a fan motor, and she filmed the effects as mosquitoes flew nearby. And she compared the number of insects that failed to land on the flat ceiling above the spinning fake tail with the number where the tail was static. The robots successfully deterred about 50% of all the pests. In addition, the approaching insects seemed unaware of the model until they were close enough to feel the 1 meter per second breeze generated by it, and then they veered away. So horses and other animals are not simply batting away flies. They are providing a breeze that deters the flies from coming near. Next story. How honest is your male dog? Well, the answer is, if he's a smaller kind of dog, then he's probably pretty dishonest. Why? Well, I've always had cats, since I'm too lazy to walk a dog or clean up after it in public. But it never occurred to me that a male dog might try to alter the height of his pee marking to make himself look bigger. Well, even though I never thought of it, Dr. Betty McGuire and her team at Cornell University endeavored to get to the bottom of this canine dishonesty once and for all. So, the actual dishonesty in question has to do with scent marking. Scent can convey, well, all sorts of information. Sex, age, health, kinship, individual identity, and social or reproductive status. And as such, scent marking is a common way for animals to transmit information about themselves into the future for other individuals to receive. And we've seen this all before, usually in the form of dogs peeing, that is transmitting, or sniffing, that is receiving neighborhood infrastructure. And interestingly, when dogs do this, the information they transmit or receive is conveyed not only in the scent signal itself, but also the space it occupies. A scent located high up on a lamppost signifies that a big dog is walking those streets. For male dogs, this potentially wards off rival males while simultaneously attracting curious females. Knowing this, the Cornell team hypothesized that adult male dogs embellish their height when urine marking, predicting that small dogs aim higher up the lamppost than large male dogs. To test this, the team first investigated whether raised leg angle is indeed a proxy for urine height mark, and it turns out it is. The researchers found that the angle between a dog's raised leg and the axis perpendicular to the ground was pretty much correlated with the height of the urine mark in similarly sized dogs. In fact, that raised leg angle was the best predictor of any proxy that they could investigate. So after they confirmed that that raised leg angle was used, McGuire and her team got to the meat of it. Do small dogs raise their legs higher? Was the angle higher than large dogs? And the answer is yes. The findings reveal that the smaller the dog, the higher the raised leg angle. This implies not only that urine marking can be dishonest, but also that small male dogs do what they can do to appear more intimidating and or alluring than they actually are. In other words, yes, male dogs lie. Next story. From time to time, I write an exam or a test or a quiz, especially in genetics, in which I will make up an unlikely animal that does not exist. in order to explore certain genetic or evolutionary points. I have had exams that have featured vampire cats, three-legged carnivores, schmooze, okay, schmooze aren't my own, luminous carnivorous creplocks, and the rare tree-climbing kangaroo. Okay, now none of these exist except in the imagination. Except for the tree-climbing kangaroo. Apparently, I actually stumbled upon something completely by accident that lives on our great planet, and it's even rarer than I explained on my genetics quiz. The Wundiwoi tree kangaroo is so rare and elusive, it disappeared over 90 years ago, and was assumed to be extinct. Not that I even knew it ever existed, mind you. Now it has not only been spotted, but also photographed for the first time ever, unlike Bigfoot and Chupacabra, which still remain at large. I knew I took that class in cryptozoology years ago for some reason. Now, why didn't my professor ever mention this creature, though? He talked plenty about Bigfoot, talked about Loch Ness Monster, never talked about tree-climbing kangaroos. Anyway, this unusual monkey-like kangaroo clambers through the trees of the montane forests of New Guinea. It had been seen there only once before by Western scientists in 1928. The Wundiwoi tree kangaroo had not been collected, seen, or reported since that first sighting. And as I demonstrate, this kanga is one of the most poorly known mammals in the world. Now an amateur botanist from the UK has led an expedition into near-impenetrable bamboo forests 5,000 feet high in the remote Wundiwoi mountains of West Papua, Indonesia, to find it. Michael Smith, any relation, Tony? He's an amateur botanist from Farnham, England, and he says, quote, "Just showing that it still exists, it's amazing. It's such a remote and difficult spot to access, I was uncertain we would ever really know," unquote. Now, tree kangaroos are tropical marsupials that are close relatives of the ground-dwelling kangaroos and wallabies. And these medium-sized kangaroos have muscly forearms to pull themselves up the trunks of trees and move around the branches using a strange mix of climbing and hopping. Again, absolutely unbelievable. Despite being little known to the world at large, they are surprisingly diverse. There are 17 species and subspecies, two in the far north of Australia, and the remainder on the huge island of New Guinea. And it, again, I didn't even realize that this was a group. So Smith led the expedition to find this rare species. He trained as a biologist as an undergraduate at university, and now works for a medical communications company. But he spends vacations trekking to remote parts of the world, Pakistan, Kurdistan, and Indonesia, on the hunt for things like rare orchids, rhododendrons, and tulips. He hatched the expedition plan after hearing about this mysterious animal while scouring West Papuan mountains for rhododendrons in 2017. With the aid of four Papuan porters and a local hunter acting as a guide, Smith trekked into the jungle on July 23, 2018, and emerged a week later with news of the find. Despite weighing up to 35 pounds, these tree kangaroos are remarkably cryptic, often remaining totally hidden high up in the forest canopy. On one of the final days of the expedition, having no luck having spotted one, the crew started to head down. And Smith says, quote, "That was when our hunters spotted a kangaroo 30 meters up. After a lot of scrambling around, trying to get my lens to focus on the animal peeking out from behind the leaves, I got a few half-decent shots," unquote. Lending to the credibility of the find, the Wundiwoi Mountains are also hundreds of miles away from suitable high-altitude habitat for related kangaroos. The Wundiwoi tree kangaroo has a very limited distribution, maybe just 40 to 80 square miles, but the numerous scratch marks and dung suggested to Smith that it was amazingly common in that very small area, though. Okay, so the last two stories of the evening are both from the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience that took place at the beginning of November in San Diego. And frankly, both of these stories seem obvious when you are first presented with them, but it's nice to see that experimental science backs up what we think we already know instinctively. So, the first of those stories out of the neuroscience conference says that the lack of sleep can induce anxiety. Yeah, I know. Like I said, I wasn't really surprised either. But in healthy adults, overnight sleep deprivation triggered anxiety the next morning, along with altered brain activity patterns. This work was done by doctors Ette Beth-Simon and Matthew Walker of the University of California at Berkeley. This was reported on November 4th. They said that people with anxiety disorders often have trouble sleeping. The new results uncover the reverse effect, that poor sleep can induce anxiety. Sleep loss makes the anxiety worse, which in turn makes it harder to sleep. Ben Simon and Walker studied the anxiety levels of 18 healthy people. Following either a night of sleep or a night of staying awake, these people took anxiety tests the next morning. After sleep deprivation, anxiety levels in these healthy people were 30% higher than when they had slept. On average, the anxiety scores reached levels seen in people with anxiety disorders. What's more, sleep-deprived people's brains changed. In response to emotional videos, brain areas involved in emotions were more active, and the prefrontal cortex, an area that can put the brakes on anxiety, was less active. This was shown by functional MRI scans. Ben Simon finished with, quote, "Our results suggest that poor sleep is more than just a symptom of anxiety, and in some cases, it may even be a cause," unquote. The other story from that neuroscience conference was that living on Lonely Street does more than make you lonely. It can actually affect the architecture of your brain for the worse. Dr. Richard Smain of Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia yanked mice out of their communities and held them in solitary isolation. Apparently, after enough time alone, they started to show signs of brain damage. After a month of being alone, the mice had smaller nerve cells in certain parts of their brains. Other brain changes followed. It's not known whether similar damage happens in the brains of isolated humans. If so, the results have implications for the health of people who spend much of their time alone, including the estimated tens of thousands of inmates in solitary confinement in the United States and elderly people in institutionalized care facilities. Smain said that he and his colleagues raised communities of multiple generations of mice in large enclosures packed with toys and mazes and things to climb. When some of the animals reached adulthood, they were taken out and put individually into typical shoebox cages, quote unquote. That abrupt switch from a complex society to isolation induced changes in the brain. Smain and his colleagues later found the overall size of nerve cells or neurons had shrunk by 20% after that month of isolation, and that shrinkage held roughly steady over 3 months as the mice remained in isolation. And to the researchers' surprise, after a month of isolation, the mouse's neurons had a higher density of spines. Those are structures for making neural connections on the message-receiving dendrites. An increase in spines is a change that usually signals something more positive. But Smain said, quote, "It's almost as though the brain were trying to save itself," unquote. And that's because by 3 months, the density of those dendritic spines had decreased back to baseline levels, perhaps a sign that the brain couldn't save itself when faced with continued isolation. The researchers uncovered other worrisome signals as well, including reductions in a protein called BDNF, which spurs neural growth. Levels of a stress hormone, cortisol, changed too. And compared with mice housed in groups, these isolated mice also had more broken DNA in their neurons, which amazed me when I read that. The researchers studied neurons in the sensory cortex, a brain area involved in taking information in and the motor cortex, which helps to control movement. It's not known whether similar effects happen in other brain areas. It's also not known how the neural changes relate to the mouse's behavior. In people, long-term isolation can lead to depression, anxiety, psychosis, and their ability to think, their brain power is affected as well. Isolated people develop problems in reasoning, remembering, navigating. Smain is conducting longer-term studies aimed at figuring out the effects of neuron shrinkage on thinking skills and behavior. He and his colleagues also plan to return isolated mice to their groups to see if the brain changes can be reversed. Those types of studies are important because he says, quote, "The question is, when have the loneliness treatments gone so far that the brain cannot be saved?" Unquote. It's a very sad question if it turns out that humans are prone to this brain degeneration as well. Well, that's all for me for now. Try not to be alone. Get plenty of sleep. Be on the lookout for vermiceous cnids in your trees. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.